My name is Dave Denniston. Welcome to a very special interview today focusing on doctors, residents, and fellows and buying their very first home. Well, here we are in this post-meltdown world of mortgage banking, and physicians face more challenges and have a higher rate of underwriter decline than virtually any other professional. Hey, it's shocking, but it's true. And just check it out. If you spend a few minutes in physician chat rooms where the topic is a mortgage, you're more than likely to read nightmare after nightmare and horror story. And it's so devastating to see what happens to a botched home loan and what closing can do to a family. Well, who better to speak to that than an expert on the subject who specializes in physicians? My guest here is Josh Middle, the author of Why Physician Home Loans Fail. Welcome, Josh.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to spend some time with you and talk about mortgages today.
Yeah, well, Josh is just the perfect guest for this subject. Not only is he the author of the book, he's in this business every single day as a loan officer. Additionally, you might want to check out some of his regular podcasts that cover over a whole variety of financial topics, and he's also seen regularly on the White Coat Investor website. Well, welcome, Josh. Let's kick this on off. Go ahead and tell us a bit about yourself. I have met so many professionals who specialize in taxes or financial planning for physicians, but never a mortgage broker. So tell us, how'd you get started? How has your career evolved to where you specialize in physicians?
That's a great question. So, you know, for about 10 years, I was like every other mortgage lender, serving typical clients and had a business based mainly in purchase business with realtors. And quite honestly, by accident, I started working with a realtor who became a close friend of mine, and his wife was doing an internship at the University of Utah Hospital. And so one thing led to another, and he kind of became the realtor of choice for relocating physicians coming into the University of Utah. Fast forward a few years later, I've done quite a few physician loans, not physician loans, but loans for physicians, and learned a few things. So in that process, I started writing blogs, I started doing YouTube videos, and I started getting calls from physicians all across the country. One time, out of the blue, I received a call from a young resident who was, and at the time we were just focused in Utah, so he was relocating to Utah. And the gentleman had been 2 months working on a home purchase, and he had been called the day before his closing, 2 days before he anticipated moving into his home with his wife and two kids. They were literally driving across the country in a U-Haul bus, and they were told that they were declined for their mortgage loan. He was wrecked. He did not know how to respond to that. He couldn't believe it, actually. He couldn't believe that he could get so deep into a transaction, supposed to have his keys the next morning, the next day, and move into his home, and at the last minute he was declined. What we found out is that the loan officer had failed to realize that he had about $170,000 in student loans, and they all showed a zero payment. So the loan officer had made the mistake of just excluding all of that debt from his debt-to-income ratio. When the loan finally made its way to an underwriter, the underwriter had not made the same mistake, and it eventually declined the loan. So we were able to salvage that loan by some of the things that we'd noted, that I had learned along the way. And from there, we really decided that it was time to go bigger, that we needed to expand, we needed to come up with our own specific physician loan programs, and then eventually that was the catalyst for writing the book and getting the information to as many physician hands as possible. Even if we didn't do their loan, we wanted them to be informed about the proper process to go about buying a home and be able to seek financing successfully.
Well, that's so good, and you hear about this from time to time, and I really had the wonderful opportunity to read through your book, and some of the reason this stuff seems to come about, you talk about in the book the difference between a mortgage broker and the underwriter and how there's this tension between the two that can lead to these issues. Can you talk about that a little bit? What's up with that?
Absolutely. And I call it the biggest conflict in mortgage banking. And quite simply, you know, the loan officer is paid to say yes. Myself included, and every loan officer in the country has never been paid on a loan that they said no to. So, you know, it's carrots and sticks. You loan officers get trained to say yes. That's where the carrots are. The conflict arises because the underwriter is the gatekeeper. The underwriter is the quality control person. The underwriter who is responsible, and truly their job and their reputation and as a professional underwriter is on the line with every loan that they sign off on. So you meet the loan officer up front. They say you're good to go. You go out, you find a home. You pack up the U-Haul van. You start your relocation across the country. The problem arises that you don't typically meet the underwriter until you're literally within a week of closing. And right. That's the person who's paid to say no. It's not that they want to say no, but it's their job to make certain that everything fits in the box. The income has to fit, credit has to fit, down payment has to fit. All of those things have to add up and qualify under the underwriting guidelines. And it's at that point where, unfortunately, clients are turned down, and you know, we get an unfortunate amount of business from clients that have gone down the path with lenders, been declined by an underwriter, and are now scrambling to find a solution. So what I talk about in the book is that we tried to reverse that process. And what we've tried to do is we've taken the underwriting process that usually happens the week before closing, and we moved that position to before you write a contract or an offer on a home. So when someone goes through our pre-approval process, they start with someone like me, a loan officer, one of the originators on our team, and then the loan and all the documents move straight on to an underwriter who then issues a credit approval and basically says, Dave, your income qualifies, we can use your employment contract, your down payment source fits, everything's going to work for a home up to $300,000. Here's your approval. Go find a home. Then once you've found a home, then we have to do the appraisal, and we have to do the title report. And that, of course, we know is part of the due diligence process of doing a home. But what we eliminate is that chance that somebody gets to the week before closing and we go, oops, we forgot to count your student loan debt into the picture.
Mm. Well, I think that's great, and something that I'm sure nobody has is you have someone on the front end, if I'm understanding you right,
yes,
to help make sure that you can qualify in the first place so you don't go through what, 3 months and 2 weeks before closing to find out, oh, I'm not going to make the loan after all.
That's right. Yeah, and just to be clear, so we basically hired an additional underwriter in the process. We've just moved that role to where it's done in the beginning of the transaction, and then once the collateral information, the appraisal and title come in on the end, it's re-reviewed. But it eliminates 99% chance that you're going to have a problem with the transaction.
That is great. One of the other things that come up a lot with a lot of the residents and fellows that I talk with is they're getting out of their residency, they're getting out of their fellowship, it's June.
Yep.
And they're moving to a new city. And I always think of this as the chicken versus the egg argument. Well, should I buy a house? Interest rates are so low, it looks great. Or should I rent? Could you outline for us this argument, buy versus rent? How should someone think about this? What should residents be considering when they move to a new place?
Yeah, and there's the opening chapter of my book, actually it's in the intro, I have a section called the Rent versus Buy Conundrum. And in that section, you know, I make a fair disclaimer that I'm a fourth generation landlord, property owner, and you know, we own a number of apartments and rental homes in the local area. And so I love real estate. I have seen real estate turn farmers and miners and landscapers, which is the family that I came from, into having wealth that they're passing on from generation to generation through passive income and free and clear rental property. So I'm about as hardcore, you know, believer in real estate as they get. So that's my fair disclaimer. Now, I go on in that section to talk about if you're not from that background, you really got to look at real estate maybe a little differently, and you need to be more cautious, because if I make a play on a home and I move a few years later, I'm going to be able to rent that home out, and I'm going to be able to leverage my expertise in doing that, and I'm probably going to make a successful investment there, whether I got to hold it for 2 years or 20, because I can ride out a storm, and I'm experienced at being a landlord.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you don't have that expertise, if you're spread too thin, if you think you may move in 3 or 4 years, and you're nervous that the market may fluctuate in that period of time, then I think you got to be really kind of calculated about it, and I think you really need to be cautious about where the local real estate market is. And there's signs. If you're buying into a real estate market that has been relatively flat and consistent, and you think there's that you can buy for approximately what you can rent for, that's probably a decent entry point. Boy. If you're entering in a market where there's multiple offers, it's heated, you can feel there's fierce competition for properties, then that is a market that is, you know, there's a lot of emotion in that market. There's a lot of signs that this may be possibly a bubble. Now the question is, does that bubble go for another 2, 3, 4 years, or is it about to burst? We don't know, but I would certainly be more cautious in your buying if you're in a hot and heated market that's on a steep increase. And the shorter duration of time you're going to be in a city, the more cautious you should be. So whenever you're seeing prices outpace rents, in other words, your mortgage payments are drastically more than what your rents are, and there's a fierce competition for properties, those are two signs to be very cautious. And if you're going to be in a home for a short period of time, you may want to lean towards renting.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. The thing I would add on that I tell clients consistently is think how long you're going to be there. If you're only going to be there 2 or 3 years, you might want to consider renting if you're not sure. But if you know you're going to be there, you should buy, especially in this current interest rate environment we're in, where it's only going to be going up over the next 5 to 10 years. Any other thoughts on that?
No, that's a great point. So I actually just did an analysis on the average 30-year fixed interest rate going back over 30 years. So annually, what was the average rate you could have got each year for the last 30 years had you locked the 30-year loan? And the average is 7.69%. Well, you know, the last 5, 6 years, we've been in the fours. So right. And in the threes. So 7% seems so foreign to us. You know, I'll talk to clients and I'll say, well, the rate's 4.5%. 4.5%? That's crazy, you know? So you've got to take that into consideration. Today, you know, we're sitting around 4.1, 3.8, somewhere in that very, very incredibly low range. So if you're going to be in that home for a long period of time, not only are you locking in the asset price, but you're locking in the debt price. And it's unusually low today, which is an advantage. I wouldn't be surprised if we ended up in that, you know, in the last 30 years, we were as high as 17%. So I think that's a very good point to take a look at where you are with interest rates in the cycle as well, depending on how long you're going to be in the home.
Well, speaking of rates, the one we see a lot is 6.8% with the student loans a lot of physicians have. And as a numbers nerd, one of the coolest things I think you addressed in the book was talking about the student debt. You addressed it a little bit, that some underwriters catch it where the mortgage broker up front doesn't. And these physicians, as they're in residency and out of residency, they're facing choices like IBR, PER, or totally deferring their loans. Can you talk about those consequences a bit and how it affects getting a mortgage?
Yeah, and so in the book, I talk about what I call danger zones. And all I mean by danger zones is there's a path that most physicians will follow that are indicative of change. So for example, when you go from med school to residency, there's a lot of change going on with those student loans. They're coming out of a deferral period and you have to make a decision. Am I going to go into a forbearance? Am I going to go into pay as you earn? Am I going to go into income-based repayment? So student loans are changing. Income is changing. If I look at your tax returns at the end of your med school career, quite likely your income is extremely low or you haven't filed taxes at all. Now you're going into making a little bit of money. You're oftentimes relocating across the country. So you've got income change, you've got debt change, you've got location change, and you're about to go into a position that, as you know, has just an insane number of hours, and that becomes kind of very stressful as you move into residency. So when you go through a period of change like that, it becomes harder to do one's loan because of all those changing factors. Same similar type circumstances happen when you go from a residency into an attending or a fellowship into attending. Student loans now come into repayment. Income's going up 300 or 400%. Oftentimes you don't have quite the down payment saved, but maybe you've got a little bit of a nest egg. And again, you're probably relocating across the country. Lots of change. Mm-hmm. And the last one would be going into private practice. So when you're going into private practice, again, there's a lot of change going on in how you're being paid from a W-2 employee to 1099 independent contractor, self-employed. So these danger zones, I call them, are areas where loans are often declined. When you're moving in between one area and another of these of lots of change, you're going to see higher rates of underwriter decline. Now, specifically speaking about med school to residency, that's really where the choice is usually made. Are we going to go into pay-as-you-earn, income-based repayment, or continue to do a forbearance? That's where loan officers tend to miss this thing a lot, because those payments don't come into repayment till towards the end of the year. So if you're going to, you know, finish your med school in May, start your residency in June or July, you're not going to be forced to make a decision on payments until December usually of that year. So the loan officers cannot wrap their arms around that change period, misjudge that, and say someone's qualified when indeed they're not. With a physician loan, we look at those and we can actually qualify someone either off of no payment if it's deferred for or in forbearance for long enough, or if they're going to be entering into an income-based repayment or pay-as-you-earn, we can qualify someone off of that payment even though they're not enrolled in it yet. So that's a nuance with a physician loan that we can say, hey, we know they're not in that yet, but we know that they're going into income-based repayment. We calculated the payment, and this is what we're going to qualify you on.
Great, great points. One other thing I would add to that is someone who has totally forbeared, deferred on their loan, and hasn't chosen it, you can still make the choice even after that period. And to Josh's point here, you could possibly avoid some heartache down the road by just enrolling in these programs. If more than likely you're working for a nonprofit right now, you can start that clock on that public service loan forgiveness program, even if you may not qualify. So
That's a great point. And let's just park there for just a second, because I want to make sure that your listeners, everybody understands that. So if I'm hearing you right, what you said was, if I make the decision as a resident to start income-based repayment, and let's say I'm married and have a child, so let's say I've got a household of three, and I've got an income of $48,000 a year, your income-based repayment or pay-as-you-earn repayment, let's say on an average student loan size of about $175,000, your payment's probably going to be 50 bucks or less a month, nominal. Even on a resident salary, 50 bucks we can come up with. So what you're saying, if I hear you right, is that even by making that $50 a month payment, you've started the clock. And that if you start working for a nonprofit and your end goal is to have some debt forgiveness, now you've started that clock making $50 a month payments, as opposed to starting the clock when you're an attending physician making a $500 or $600 a month payment. Did I hear you right?
Yeah, you hit it right on the head. And just to add to that, even if you are going not to nonprofit, at least your loan balance isn't getting bigger and bigger and bigger with the $100, $200, $300 you're paying towards the thing every month. So get her done.
Yeah, well said.
All right, well, let's move on here. One of the other things that with mortgages that many loan officers, I think, miss is the opportunity to avoid PMI, mortgage insurance. And I think this can be such a waste of money, because essentially you if you're not having a 20% down payment, you're paying this extra monthly payment in order to have the home. So Josh, tell us about how can doctors avoid PMI? How does that work? What's available to young physicians who want to buy a house?
Yeah. So first of all, let's be clear with what PMI is. PMI is, and so conventional loans have PMI, private mortgage insurance. Government loans like FHA have a mortgage insurance premium, but they don't call it private because it goes to the federal government as insurance. But essentially, if you're putting less than 20% down, you have a form of mortgage insurance, whether you go conventional or FHA. And that insurance is a forced insurance charged to you as the borrower, but insures the bank. So you get no benefit out of that. Now, not only do you get no benefit, but you can't write it off on your taxes anymore. So in 2015, the new ruling was from the IRS that mortgage insurance is no longer tax deductible. So it's really lost money. With a physician loan, what you're going to find is that you can finance up to 100%, you know, depending on what state you're in, depending on what price range you're in, maybe you're going to have a 5% down or a 0% down possibility, but up to 100% financing, and you'll not have any mortgage insurance. Now, what you will find is that the interest rates are slightly higher. So maybe you're going to pay an extra quarter to 0.375 higher in rate, but you're saving FHA mortgage insurance is 1.35, so you save a full percent annually. Conventional mortgage insurance is usually somewhere between 0.7 and 0.9 annually, as opposed to a 0.3 higher rate. Now, in addition, remember that 0.3 higher rate is tax deductible, so you take a third off of that. So really, you know, you're less than a quarter higher in rate, as opposed to 0.7 to 1.3 in mortgage insurance. So let's call it you save a point a year on a $250,000 loan. That's $2,500 a year. Over the first 10 years, that saves you $25,000. So it really can add up.
Well, and to that point, I think one of the things I'd encourage people to watch out for, you are paying a little extra, but a year from now, 2 years from now, I bet you'll be seeing much higher interest rates than you are today. So you might be paying a quarter percent more, but at least you've locked in a mortgage at the 4.25, 4.5, 4.75, whereas a year, 2 years from now, we could be looking at easily 5.5, 6% mortgages again, depending on what happens with interest rates.
Absolutely. Great point. You're able to leverage a higher loan to value and, historically speaking, at an incredibly low cost of credit.
All right. Now, the other thing that you address in the book, which so many people aren't aware of because they don't have a good mortgage broker, is the good faith estimate, the GFE. Tell us about this good faith estimate. What should doctors be looking out for there?
Yeah, this is one of the most common questions we get from clients is, you know, when should I get a good faith estimate? What's on it? What should I expect? There's just a lot of questions around this document. And the current good faith estimate, as we're recording this in October 2014, has some holes in it, in that it does not show your total payment with taxes and insurance and homeowners association if you have a homeowners association dues. It also wouldn't show your monthly mortgage insurance, by the way, if you have it. It will not show your total cash to close. It doesn't show anything that needs to go into an escrow account for taxes and insurance. It doesn't show any kind of credits that the seller may be giving you to cover your closing costs. So, you know, it's like, here's this official government document, but it doesn't tell you what your payment is or how much you need to bring to closing. So that's the downside of the current good faith estimate. The upside of that document is it does quantify costs. So what it says is, once I issue you a good faith estimate, it's my promise. It's our federal, I'm under federal law. I have to deliver that loan at those fees and at that interest rate, or, you know, if we can't deliver the loan, then the loan has to be declined. But it's one or the other. It can't change. So that's good. Now, in 2015, it's either August or October this rolls into effect. I think it's October 2015, we're going to get a new good faith estimate. And this baby's going to be like 5 or 6 pages long. That should be very simple to understand, right?
If the government doesn't need it, so no.
Yeah. I mean, come on. You can't hire another 100 attorneys if you're going to keep the form 2 pages. You're going to have to get this thing, you know, a little more robust. So we're told that this good faith estimate will have everything under the sun, moon, and stars in it. It'll have your total settlement funds to close, and so maybe it'll improve in the future. But what I suggest is this. What you want is you want what I call a fee worksheet or a closing worksheet that's going to approximate your cash to close, show all your credit, show your earnest money, show the total payment with taxes and insurance and everything, as well as a good faith estimate. Because your good faith estimate will say, here's my guarantee on the rate, here's my guarantee on the fees, and that should match a fee worksheet that says, and here's your cash to close, and here's your payment. And with those two things together, you can really put the picture in frame.
Great. Well, this has been great advice, Josh. You've really given a lot of meat for us to chew on and think about and to help out physicians. So this is wonderful information. In case people want a copy of your book or they want to contact you with questions, where can they reach you? Where can they get a copy of your book?
Yeah, and Dave, I mentioned before we started the recording that for your clients, for your listeners, I would offer to give them a free copy of the book, and I'll send them an ebook, And all they need to do is just email me at josh@joshmetal.com and just say, send me a book on Dave. And I'll send them out a book and allow them to have a copy of that. And if you have any questions, you can actually go to the website, whyphysicianhomeloansfail.com, and you can get the first chapter for free. And then you can query me with any questions there as well.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, Josh. We'll dig into this maybe a little bit more and talk more about some of these kind of things in the future. I think you have some other things on your mind that might be good to cover. Do you want to talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, I think, you know, we should do part two, and we can talk about, you know, the buying season's just around the corner. Match season's in March, relocation season is right after that, and if we want to get into the different types of loan programs, what kind of an analysis between, you know, should we put a down payment or should we invest our down payment maybe in some sort of an investment vehicle, we can launch into that and do a part two. Love to join you again.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for watching. For the Capital Advisory Group, this is Dave Denniston and Josh Metal. Look forward to talking to you soon. Take care.